My name is Jack Rose, and I'm an alcoholic. I want to talk to a friend of mine before I get into this. Harvey, I'm here today to rebut everything you said. I used to like you, but because I thought you were kind of a nice guy, but you turned out to be a real no-gooder. You talk, you're a horrible man, so don't call me anymore. Just pay attention to the people in Covina. That was for Harvey Angers, who was here a couple of weeks ago. I've known him since he came in, and he's quite a character. I'd never heard him, the way he talked. It was absolutely amazing. I really didn't think he was that kind of a guy. My God, he was shooting people and going to jail and doing all sorts of antisocial things that I didn't think good alcoholics did. You just got drunk and peed in the corner, and that was about the size of it to get you here. Be that as it may, I came here as a non-conforming alcoholic because I didn't know what an alcoholic was. I didn't even know what alcoholism was. And I'm sure that most everybody in this room did the same thing unless you'd gone through one of those 28-day things three or four times, and they'll tell you what it is. But in the days that I came in, the only information that came about was from those who had preceded me on this Alcoholics Anonymous program. Very interesting that when I came in, the old timers were 6 years old. One who has been with us for so many years and who just recently passed away, Sybil Corwin, had 57 years on this program. And she was one of the old timers when I came in. Incidentally, any of you who knew her or are interested in the memorial service they're going to have for her, it's going to be on Saturday, June 6th, at the War Memorial Building in South Pasadena at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. She, I think, she was the oldest woman, member of Alcoholics Anonymous since Marty Mann passed away. And she's been quite ill, and it was a blessing that she finally was taken away to join whatever group of people were up wherever she's going to go. But in those days, the information about alcoholism and the alcoholic came from the membership who had been here for a while and had found a way to explain it to the newcomers who came here. They didn't have much literature in those days, so you couldn't get all of the intellectual ideas as to what is going on in the disease of alcoholism and in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. All they had to do to teach us was what they had learned talking to each other, and that's the reason I think that the book had preceded the idea by saying that it's one drunk talking to another. That's where the information comes. And speaking about that, the book Alcoholics Anonymous is the only answer to your problem of recovery. Anything that I say or anybody else in the fellowship has to say means absolutely nothing when it's in your behalf. You can accept some of it, you can reject it, you can believe it or you can deny it. But when it comes down to your very particular problem, your particular effort to recover from the problem that you think you have to get in the book. That's where the answer is. The book is such a wonderfully written thing that it has been able to survive over 62 years without changing but two or three words in it. The message is the same. You do things here in this meeting that I dislike. To begin with, I hate to hear the Chapter 3 read at any meeting. I think it's an abomination. I think it's a disservice to the new people, and it certainly is a disservice to those of us who've been around a while to have the third chapter read here at the meeting. First place, we are a group of people who are great talkers, but poor listeners. So nobody listens to what is being read. Third chapter, if I were to rewrite this book, I'd make it number one. I'd be right up front. More about alcoholism. But that's where you find out what an alcoholic is. If you take this book and you're having some problem with understanding or discussing or denying, take it a book and sit someplace quiet where nobody's going to bother you, where there won't be any phones, and the family won't come in and bother you. And sit there and read this thing sentence by sentence. And at the end of every sentence, take time to think about what you read and say, how do I fit into that, or do I? And you will find that in the course of reading this chapter 3, that you will be totally aware of what this disease of alcoholism is, what an alcoholic is, and where you fit into the plan of recovery that's on here. Then I have chapter 2, which says there is a solution. These two things work hand in hand to offset our denial and our wondering what comes next. And it seems to me that progression would have been much better. But, who can knock it? It's worked this much. It's a very interesting thing. I notice that this meeting, like others, starts out by saying there are no dues or fees, but there's certainly a greater number of things that you have to do. You read 25 things that you have to do about being part of this meeting. Bill Wilson, I had lunch with him one day, and we were talking about various and sundry things. I wasn't alone with him. I was with two or three other the men who always went with him to lunch or dinner when he came out here. His mother lived in La Jolla, and he'd come out three or four times a year to visit her, not for anything in AA, but just to visit his mother. And when he did, he would come up from La Jolla, and several of us would meet him, and we'd have either lunch or dinner. And this one lunch we were having, we were discussing various and sundry things, and I said to him, is there anything that you would change if you were to write the book again? And he says, there sure is. And I said, what is that? He said, I would have left out this no dues or fees. He said, I didn't know that when alcoholics, drunks get sober, they become the cheapest, tightest people in the world. So I would have left that out. And that's pretty true today. Go out to a bar, and you buy the bar a drink, and that's $25, $50, $100. Bask in the people who are telling you what a great guy or gal you are. And then you get sober, and the basket passes. And do you put in $1 or $2? Absolutely not. Many of us pass it by because now I got to take kids home some milk or something like that. So we become very, very tight with our money, which I think is quite unfair to those who come here. So I'm on a kick of bitching now, so don't pay much attention to it anyway. I also have a very deep feeling about attendance of meetings. The very fact that you are told right in the front when you first came in here that the thing that was necessary for you to maintain a state of soberness and begin a growth pattern of recovery, you had to attend the meetings. This was a must, and it still is a must. We were talking a little earlier about some older people on the program who don't come to these meetings. I think it's a shame that they don't, for two reasons. The reasons for most people getting drunk who come here are because they don't go to the meetings. They say, well, I've had enough, or they're boring, or whatever. And they don't go to the meetings. Plus the fact they are derelict in their duty when they don't come to meetings to help another alcoholic. That's what this program says, that we're here to recover from our seemingly state of mind and body and to carry the message of recovery to other alcoholics. And you can't do that when you're sitting home watching television or whatever you're doing. This place is where you should be. If it is your group, you should be there. When I first came in, I was told, pick a chair. And this is my home group is Arlington down in Los Angeles. And I was told to pick a chair in that meeting. And I thought that was a strange suggestion, so I said, why? They said, because it'll be your chair, and you be in that chair every meeting night. Don't miss it. And so I picked a chair, and I sat there and thought, well, it's no different than any other chair, but I'll do that. It wasn't very long till the wisdom came about, because people would come in, and I was one who would do this. And I'd look around at some of the chairs people had set in day after day and week after week. And if I didn't see them there, there was just a feeling of loss, just something was missing in that particular group. Just the very fact that you sat in a chair is the greatest 12-step work you can do. 12-step work to the newcomer is a wonderful thing, no doubt about that. But of much more importance is the 12 step you do for your neighbor who sits there. Maybe he's got 30 years, maybe he's got 10 years, whatever the case might be, for you to just to be there to show him that this will work, particularly the newer people up to 5 or 6 years, something like that, to see you there every week. They can't very fully comprehend, but they can't deny the fact that this is a place that you find that which is necessary to stay sober. So when I came in here, I was not an alcoholic. I'd been on a 3-year drunk, and I'd had myself a pretty nice time, I thought. I didn't consider getting sober. I had done that's a sober bit several times in the previous time before this happened. But my wife at the time decided I should get sober, and she made the contacts that brought a man to take me to my first meeting in the Arlington group, which occurred on September 16th, 1946. And I haven't found it necessary to even consider taking a drink from that day to this. For some reason, certainly, I would blame it on, I said, well, blame it. I consider that God had something to do with it, but in those days, I had no use for or belief in God as such or power greater than yourself. I wanted no part of it. And for that reason, my first period of years in Alcoholics Anonymous were very limited as to what the program part I could work. I was an agnostic. I would not believe in anything of a spiritual nature. Wouldn't let you try to convince me about God as you understand it. So I was confined to the first step and the last part of the 12th step. So I admitted I was powerless over alcohol, and that was sort of with tongue-in-cheek, too. And my life had become unmanageable, and that was a very hard thing for me to reconcile. I didn't see anything wrong with my life. I didn't see what was unmanageable. What did I have to manage the way you did? I didn't do anything else the way you did, so why should I manage my life the way you did it? And I was very happy. I traveled around the country. I took freight trains all over this country, stopped in various cities and in various camps for the indigent and so forth. Spent a little time in jail to recuperate from drinking once in a while. I didn't say anything unmanageable about that. If I didn't like where I was, I went someplace else. And if you didn't like what I was doing, either you could go or I would go. It didn't make any difference. And when I finally got out of service in World War II and came into Los Angeles and got a bar in the Hollywood area, everything was fine. I didn't see anything wrong at all with the manageability of my life. There was an interesting thing. Years ago, there was a man who was a ex-warden of Sing Sing Prison. But he talked to one of our institutional meetings at one of the conferences in Pasadena, and he posed a problem, and he said, you know, you people think you're special, that the rest of the world should sort of conform to the way you live. But he said, imagine Skid Row area in Los Angeles having 100,000 drunks like you are. And I walked in, and I'm sober. And I walked in the midst of this 100,000 people. And I'm, who's right and who's wrong then? Am I right, did one single person in that group? Or are the 100,000 doing exactly as they think is right? And it posed quite a time of my thinking about that sort of thing. We try very hard to let people know about this program, and that's perfectly all right, too. But some of us preach very hard about it. I'm not one of those. I figure once you're given all that you could possibly give to the newcomer who is here or to the one who's wondering what about, then it's up to them to do what this program suggests from the very beginning. There's another thing that I was told when I first came in that seemed to be still part of my everyday thinking. That was, I was told when I was born that I got onto this earth that this power, whether I believed it or not, had given me the right of choice. And for many years, I had the right of choice. It was my decision to do. It was my decision to cry when I was wet, to cry when I was hungry. It was my decision as I grew up to do the things that I did. So that was a part of my life, and I think it's a part of everybody else's life. And then they said those of us who became alcoholic, who drank beyond our capacity to withstand, that power of choice was taken away from us by this power greater than ourselves and placed in the hands of alcohol. And for a period of time as you drank, we had no choice as to what we're going to do. How many times had I said, I'm not going to drink today, knowing full well I am anyway, go out and get drunk again. Time after time after time. Everything was predicated on what the drink was going to do to me. The actions that I took while drinking was because the booze said this is what we're going to do. Then they said, but once you come to Alcoholics Anonymous and you walk through the door the very first time, that power of choice is given back to you, never to be taken away. It is then, from then on until the day that you die, you have the right of choice, particularly in the drinking area. You can choose to drink or not to drink. You can't blame it on anything else except your own decision to do just that, to drink or not to drink. You can bring up many, many things that are reasons, supposedly, to take a drink, but they're only really not reasons whatsoever. And you've heard a lot of them. I've heard a lot of them. I'm different than you. I'm different than this. I never did that. I never went to jail, etc. Or you went to jail, but I went to prison. And all of these sort of things are things that bear upon our thinking and gives us the opportunity to drink again and blame it onto somebody supposedly with immunity. But in fact, the thing remains that you made the decision to drink, and you'll have to make the decision to stay sober if that's what you choose to do. And it's a wonderful thing that these ideas that come to us from this book reading is our own personal adventure within the recovery program. Many of the things that I talk about and that I think about, you couldn't stand and you couldn't do. That's perfectly all right, you know. Many things, such as I've never been a sponsor. I've never had a sponsor. I never will have a sponsor, really. I don't want to be a sponsor. Chuck Chamberlain and I used to discuss that great lengths. He was the same thing. No way am I going to be a sponsor for another human being. How do I know I'm right? How do I know I'm right? Maybe I'm telling you something that in God's plan is totally wrong and it's going to be detrimental to you. So we never were sponsors. My reason for not being a sponsor is semantic, of course. I've had people talk to me over the years and ask me to be a sponsor, and I say no. And then they ask me a question, can I help them with this, that, or the other thing? And I tell them that I'll be a friend. A friend is very much different than a person who puts on the idea or the hat of the sponsor. Because in being a friend, I tell them, and Chuck Chamberlain told them, there's a couple others in this area who are in the same frame of mind, that being a friend means just this. If you ask me something and I can answer it, if it's been something I have been through, I'm going to tell you exactly the steps that I took to get outside of that particular situation. And if it makes a merit to you, you can use it if you want to. But I don't care whether you use it or not. It doesn't make any difference to me. A sponsor would say, if you don't go the way I say, I get another sponsor. But in being a friend, you just tell them what you did to encompass a recovery from that particular situation, or if you've not been in it, I have a way of saying that too. This is what I think I might do, but since I've never been in an area to fulfill the actions taken, all I can tell you is I think maybe this is what I might do. And once again, you can take it or you can leave it alone, and I don't care. It doesn't make any difference to me whether you do anything at all, because in this book of recovery, it is one drunk talking to another. And as we go through this drinking process, do we find a key element of understanding? And it has worked very well for me, very, very much. There's a number of things that go along with that as we travel along this period of recovery. And that is that we have to understand that everybody has a right to be wrong. Everybody. I don't care. Most of you are wrong, in my opinion, but that's all right. You have a right to be wrong, you see. It works out extremely well that way, because then there's no pressure on me whatsoever. One of the men who, and in fact, one of the men, the man, the one particular person who has meant more to me in this program of recovery than any other human being ever could be, and sometimes I think even more so than this power that I now have a small, slight idea of what it is. But he told me about this friendship thing. And he said, I want you to know that as I am not a sponsor for you or anybody else, but I will be your friend. And I thought, well, that's all right. And then he continued by saying, and as your friend, I will remain so until I say differently. And I thought, gee, that's a funny thing to say to, you know, I had no idea. A short time thereafter, I don't know how many months later, I got in a situation with him and we argued. We had quite a Donnybrook with each other. And for several days, I didn't talk to him. And I talked to him every day for 8 years, except in this period when I was angry with him. So I called him up one day and I thought, I might as well get this out on the table. So I said, Jim, I want to tell you right up front, I'm not your friend anymore. I don't have anything to do with you anymore. This discussion we had has made it impossible for me to be with you or to have anything to do with you at all. And he started to laugh. And I said, it isn't funny. What are you laughing about? And he said, because it finally is true. I found out you're not listening to me. So what do you mean I'm not listening to you? He said, I told you that I was going to be your friend until I said so, and I haven't said so yet. So we ended up, I laughed, of course, and we went on with that. We didn't have any other arguments whatsoever. That name was Jim Kendall, who took it upon himself to tell me he was going to teach me what he knew about this. He's one of those old-timers of 6 years, and that's that. He hoped I learned well enough that I, in turn, could teach, and as those I taught would learn well enough, and they, in turn, would teach, so that this program of recovery would continue to be available to all the drunks yet to come, and there's going to be a myriad of them throughout the years. As you know, we never are at loss for some newcomers. Some of them are not really newcomers. Some of them have been in and out and in and out. It doesn't make any difference. Everybody who comes into this meeting or any other meeting that you go to, regardless of how many years on this program, you will find that there's something new that will be said that you'll have not heard before, and it will enhance your program some way or another. And so this thing has been for me a very interesting life. I'm very much in love with the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I think it is the greatest thing that ever happened to this world, entitled, not just us, but to the whole world. The philosophy that is old as man itself is a tremendously wonderful thing. And had the Ten Commandments not been so much thou shalt not, they could have possibly done what this is doing here with our positiveness of these principles of recovery. It's a totally amazing thing. And so, as I say, I'm definitely fully involved with and in love with program Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not so sure from time to time about the fellowship. Some of you people are rather weird, and it makes a big difference. But the program does never find itself being changed whatsoever. Many strange things have happened and situations have occurred. One thing that Bill said one day when we were talking at a meeting, and he said, you know, there's a very strange thing happened. Bill had a bit of a time, as you know, to reconcile God as you understand him. But he said, Bob and I, the first meeting, outside meeting that we went to, we were discussing the program and the coming up meeting and so forth. And he said, either Bob or I, and I don't recall which one it was, said to the other one, you know what would be a good idea? And that's to ask God to join us as we go to this meeting. And we agreed that was a very excellent idea. And he said, we went to the meeting. And it was an interesting thing. We felt that God was there. And he said, the most interesting thing is that we find that God liked it so well that he's never missed a meeting since. That's a pretty astute question, and I think it's pretty true. Now, as an agnostic, myself, I didn't believe in this thing. I argued with people, the people walk away from me at the meetings, and I maintained this depth of not believing in this thing for a matter of 6 years. I wouldn't talk about the power greater yourself or anything else. So in order to, as I see it now, in order to stay sober, the thing that I had going for me, if nothing else, was activity in the program, was action in the program. It was coming to the meetings and utilizing the first step, and as I say, the last part of the third step, carrying the message to another alcoholic. And after several years of this thing, Jim would give me some very enlightened ideas about it, and I didn't believe him, so I didn't follow up with it. But one day the members of our group said, they started in with a concerted effort by many of them to offset my agnosticism by telling me that if I didn't believe and come to believe in a power greater myself, I would not make this program. I would not be successful in it. And I went to Jim and I said to him, I might as well quit. I'm not going to believe in this fantasy that you talk about. You people are immersed in this thing that you can't explain, you can't see, you can't touch, you don't know where it is, you don't know whether it's a man or a woman, nothing do you know about this thing you talk about with such gleam in your eyes. And I'm not going to believe in that kind of thing. So I might as well quit. And Jim said, no. He said, what's the second step say? And I'd heard that 10,000 times, of course. So I quoted it to him, came to believe the power greater than ourselves would restore us to sanity. And he said, yeah, that's the way it's written, but what does it mean? What's the important part of it? We discussed a while, it finally came out, that came to believe was the important part of that particular step, came to believe. And he said, I personally will guarantee you that if you continue to go to these meetings and listen with as open a heart as you could have, and one day you too will come to believe. Since he'd never lied to me, for some reason I took that as all I needed to know, and I simply forgot that I did not believe. I didn't immediately pick up with the knowledge of or the belief in, but I went along to these meetings being active in all sorts of various ways. And after 6 years, standing up at the meeting as I always did, wouldn't say the Lord's Prayer, wouldn't do anything with you, just stand there. The man standing next to me pointed out I was now saying the Lord's Prayer. I was not aware of that. That was 6 years after I'd been in this program, going to meetings every single day. Didn't miss a day in those first 6 years. And I started saying the Lord's Prayer, and to this day, I don't know why. I have not been able to pinpoint anything at all that gives me any idea as to why that particular time it just seemed natural to say the Lord's Prayer. But from that day on, it began to grow, this feeling of the power. And because discussing with many of the people, the power became a reality that I could see. We were looking out the window today at the hillside with the trees and the flowers on it. My dad told me when I told him I didn't believe in this thing called God, I was going to be an atheist. He said, you can't be an atheist unless you can answer a question. And I said, what's the question? And he said, science today can take all the components of a seed. Seed that a flower has dropped or something like that. They can take everything and make it exactly the same, to the same proponents with the same kind of a hull on the outside of it. Take those two things, the real seed and this one that the science has brought forth, plant them into the ground, and he said, which one will grow? And I said, well, of course the real flower will. He said, why? I had no answer to that. He said, you answer that, you could be an atheist. Otherwise, you've got to convince yourself to be an agnostic. There's something there, but you're not aware of it, and let it go at that. And that's why I became an agnostic and stayed that way for that many years. It was also an interesting thing. The people of AA are very, very prone to help you out. They really do when they start talking about it. He had asked me one time, Jim had asked me one time, to find the most important thing in the book. And he said, I want you to know that what you're looking for is your life. You better find it. So I began reading the book. As many of you have heard me say before, I was not allowed to get the book for 60 days. I was not allowed to read beyond the fourth chapter for 8 months, every day for 8 months, up to the fourth chapter, period, no further. Finally, after the end of 8 months, I was told to continue to read the book. And getting the book to me was quite an interesting thing, too. I had been with the program quite a while, and I didn't have a book. And so the members of my group was the same old thing. If you don't get a book, you're not going to make this program. So I went to Jim, and I said, you know, they tell me if I don't get a book, I won't make this program. He said, I'll tell you when to get the book. And we went on and went to the meetings every night together. And one day he said to me, tomorrow night bring the money because we're going to buy the book. And this was about 2 or 3 months after I'd been in, I guess. I said, well, I may not have the money, Jim. Tomorrow things are kind of tough in my life. He said, I didn't ask you that. I just told you to get the money because we're going to buy the book. And I said, you're not listening. I may not have the money. He said, I don't want to hear that. Steal it if you have to, but bring the money and get the book. And I said, I thought it was an honest program. He said, we'll take care of that later. Just get the money and we'll buy the book. Next night, we got the book. And on the way home, I said to him, how come you didn't buy this book for me? Everybody I talk to has supposedly a baby that they buy the book, give it to them. And he said, I owe you the book. That's why I didn't buy it for you. You, it's your responsibility. It's your life. Your responsibility. You buy the book. He said, you know, one of the things that you'll find as you go along is that the sense of responsibility is a grave and heavy thing to be a part of. But it's there and you can't do anything about it. And your responsibility starts the minute you walk through the door. Right then, your responsibility to yourself and to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is in your hand. And I said, sometime I won't have any money. He said, doesn't make any difference. You got a dime, put in a nickel. If you got a quarter, put in a dime. Got a half a buck, put in a quarter. One of these days you will fulfill your personal responsibility by helping to support that which gives you the opportunity to discuss with other people the difference between drinking and being sober. And he said, so don't ever let the basket go by and let me see you not put something in the basket. And I said, okay. So I continued to do that and still do today. And then I became a fetish. At my age, natal as well as AA, I take liberties with a lot of things. And one of the things that I do is about just passing the basket business. I was at the Radford Club years ago, and I keep watching the basket to see who's a jerk who isn't putting in for their own responsibility. And they had a number of 12-step house men who were coming to that meeting, a noon meeting at Radford. And I watched this one day, and a young man who was quite well dressed with these group of people from the Chandler Lodge, he got up and he went out and he got two cups of coffee, a handful of cookies. He bought three Cokes before the day was over, going out again, went to the machine, got a pack of cigarettes and came back in. I don't know how much money that actually amounted to, but probably $4 or $5, something like that. When the basket came, he passed it by. So I went and got the basket, stood right in front of him, and I said, put some money in the basket. He says, I don't have to. I said, what do you mean you don't have to? He says, there's no dues or fees. I said, for everybody else in here, that's true, but for you, put some money in the basket. So he pulled out a roll of bills, and he took off a dollar, and he slammed it in the basket, and he got up, and he walked out. And after the meeting, all the do-gooders in the meeting came up to me, and they're giving me hell. Come from breakfast. But I probably drove that man out. He probably would die because he'll go get drunk again, and they go through the regular routine. And I said, doesn't make any difference. I don't care if he gets drunk or not. What I'm interested in is we got his dollar, and that's what we needed here. A year later, I'm at the Commercial Wave meeting. And I took up the 7th floor. As you all know, Commercial Wave's got a long building. And some guy standing up in the back of the room was waving a dollar bill. And after the meeting, he came up. I didn't recognize him. And he came up and he said, did you see me? And I said, yeah, I saw you. What's that for? He said, I just want you to know, I'm the one that you made put a dollar in the basket a year ago at Radford. And I want to tell you, I haven't missed a dollar in the basket in any meeting I've ever gone to since. So it did some good. You know, you got to sometimes tell these newcomers that there are certain rules and regulations about responsibility that you have to take and be a part of. And that was it. And, of course, many things have gone along that we've had that are absolutely fantastic. I said the reason I stayed sober was through the fellowship of action and activity. I was told to do that very early. So I did, but unbeknownst to me, it was going to happen. But the gal named Winlaws, who wrote the last story of the book here, Freedom from Bondage, she'd gone out to visit a friend of hers who was in the hospital and talked about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and a couple of nurses heard her. To make a long story short, they asked her if she could come back and talk to her friend again. And she said yes, and she came home and called me at 11 o'clock at night. Said, I've got something for us to do. And I'd only known her a couple of weeks. She had a week ahead of me in the program. And she said, tomorrow morning I'll get with you because I got something for us to do, I think. Next morning we met, and so she told me what had happened, and she said, I think we should do something to get AA to be put into the various institutions, the hospitals and jails if possible, and to carry this message to the inmate and the patient. And I said, okay. So we started doing that. It took us 2 years to get anybody to allow us to come into their institution. But we kept at it because we were true alcoholics who, as you all know, we have one thing in common above all else, and that is if you say somebody tells you you can't do something, you're going to do it, come hell or high water. Nothing's going to stop you from doing it. And so we kept at it until we got this institutional committee activity to be allowed into prisons and into the jails and into the hospitals. And it was an interesting point how the attitudes changed in AA. From the beginning, you people would have nothing to do with that idea. And you would tell us very strongly, this has nothing to do with Alcoholics Anonymous. You can't do this. It's against all the regulations and rules of AA. I've never been able to find that in the book, but they keep repeating that's what it is. We finally got another couple, and the four of us took on the carrying the message into the various places. And finally, little by little, you people began to believe maybe there was something to this. And so, as you know, today there's some 22 or 23 institutional committee activities in Southern California, carrying I don't know how many places they take the message of Alcoholics Anonymous now. But in those days, we took where we could go. So the sheriff's department here was one that we were able to get into his road camps and into his prisons. And then we got into Chino in the state and so forth. And the activity process was to be there. And we made that one of the unwritten rules of the institutional committee was that if we were allowed to come in, we would come in at the time stipulated, wouldn't miss under any circumstances unless it was physically impossible to get there. We would take nothing in and bring nothing out. And I'm pretty sure that is still being adhered to 99% of the time at least. So that what you go into is to take the message of recovery. Now, you can all wonder how I could be active in that and not believe in the program. I had no idea about this thing called God. I couldn't talk about it, didn't want to talk about it. And yet, everybody that I talked to, and even as reading the book, it all refers consistently to the fact that the belief in a power greater than yourself is a thing that's going to change your life. How can I tell you about this change of life in my life when I don't believe? And so I gave words to this. I read the book, and I talk in a quote from the book, the various places that it says God as you understand it. And I never really pointed out that I didn't believe unless somebody followed me. And I said, well, I'm just coming to believe, I suppose. And it went on and on and on. So the program in itself, in that book, can do so much to keep you sober. So very, very much. Through the activity of that, I began to look more at the program. And you know now, and all of you know, because I'm sure all of you at least opened the book once, that shows in the 12 principles. The first one talks about alcohol. Step one. next time you hear anything about alcohol is in the last part of chapter 12, from the second through the first two-thirds of the 12th step. These are places where not alcohol is not mentioned once. Doesn't talk about alcohol, doesn't talk about alcoholism, doesn't talk about the alcoholic. It talks about a program of change of attitude to allow you to live in this world without the need of taking a drink. You do this through your change of attitude as you go along the way. You do that, I think, by being active, understanding full well the merits of this program. This program brings forth one idea that is stronger than most anything else in the book, and that's just the principle of unity, the principle of humility. These two things are probably the saving grace of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous for most of us in this room. Humility is not only an action, it's also a thought, an idea. But the biggest thing that this humility will do is to relieve you and me of the knowledge of self. The book talks about selfishness and self-centeredness being one of our gravest things that are wrong. And this state of humility will give us the opportunity to throw away that part of our ego and present with us in place of it, which has to be done. We replace it with service. And service has two places, in my opinion. First place is the greatest service we can give is to this God as you understand it. How do you do that? For maybe prayer every day, giving blessings and thanking Him for the grace of the day. My, what a wonderful thing it is to walk out today and like this day, this beautiful, beautiful day. Go down the street, see what's happening around the street, see the people who are happy and enjoying this day, and watch the trees bloom and blossom and the flowers, and see people's eyes begin to glisten, and see little kids playing in the park and enjoying this whole thing. And it's all because this power's grace has given us the right to be, it should be enough of familiar with them to thank them very gravely about what we have been given in these days. And the second service is to those about us. Not only the alcoholic, I find that many times there are people who need somebody to talk to, even somebody to smile at you. When you walk down the street, I don't know what about you, but when I used to walk down the street, I wouldn't smile at you if you had pink hair. The hell with that. Nowadays, I find that I can smile to people and I can say hello, and I've done this many times. I've been able to say hello to people, go a few steps and turn around and look at them, and they turn around and look at me like I'm nuts, you know. What's me saying hello? I don't know him. There's the idea that I get it, and I just smile again and keep on walking, and it's a good thing. And so I began to believe in the power greater myself in a very minor way. And I needed something to prove to me. I don't pray. I had a very tough time, still do, with this prayer factor. But again, each of us have our own way of doing this sort of thing, and who's to say we're wrong? If it's working, it's right for you, whatever it is. And in this prayer business, I found that I couldn't believe very much in the way you prayed. I couldn't believe that the third step or the seventh step or the 11th step prayer really had anything to do with my part of this recovery situation. It just didn't make sense to me. And since I didn't know how to pray, never had, although my family was a Christian family, and my dad, mother, and sister went to church every Sunday, and sometimes in the activities during the week, and I went grudgingly when they forced me to, but never heard anything, was sent to Episcopalian military school beat reform school, really. And it was there that I became an altar boy, not believing in one word that the priest said on the stage at all, didn't believe it at all, but there were perks. And even young alcoholics know the difference between being one of the gang and getting something special. And the special we got there was time out of being in the school in Salina, Kansas. And so when it came time here to talk about prayer, now, I'm not one who's ever gotten down on my knees and say, "Dear God, help me out." I hear and I believe it 100% for you people. And when things are going real tough, the real alcoholic prayer is, "Please help me. please help me. Many people that I've talked to have used that and found it a decided turn in their life and their thinking at that particular time. But I couldn't quite accept that. So I had to come up with a prayer that I thought would work for me. I do now, however. I will stand up and say the Lord's Prayer with you, or the Serenity Prayer at the end of the meeting, but that's as far as it goes. My prayer on a daily basis is one that affects me wonderfully well. That is, I get up in the morning and I say whatever, and I get dressed and go about my day's work. And at the end of the day, when I get ready to climb into bed, I say enough, and I go to bed. That whatever and enough is my prayer for a day. I know that my God, if I don't understand him but would like to understand him better, knows that when I say whatever, that I am aware of the fact that if there's anything during this day that I am unable to handle in a good way or even in a bad way, that he is there and he will take care of it and the day will work out all right, fine. And at the end of the day, I don't have to worry anything about what's going to happen tomorrow. Am I going to be able to pay the rent? If the day is over, 24 hours that I lived this day, it's the only day I have, and it's over now, so I will sleep, and hopefully will awake the next morning with another whatever for that day. So it makes every 24 hours a very interesting time of my life. When I first came in here, I did a couple of things that were a little different. You all talk about 24-hour day program, one day at a time. That's a big thing. They used to say that, but in a different way. They would say, you say you're here to stay sober on an all-time basis, one day at a time. Always preceded that one day at a time by on an all-time basis. But you're going to do that. You have your goal set out here to, as long as you're going to be around. And then you do this thing at one day at a time, whatever you learn about. So learning this idea of prayer, I found that it's hard for me to understand it would work. And yet, here I am staying sober. Here I am now being able to go through the rest of the steps, the principles of recovery, each one of them bringing a different thing to me. That since it wasn't talking about alcohol, it was talking about me. And the men were very, very, very happy to share with me what they thought these principles meant and how you work for them. As an example, the fourth step, when you take an inventory. That inventory has absolutely nothing to do with your wife or your boss or anything else. It has to do with you. Talks about you. Made a personal inventory of yourself. This is a place where you open up the old wounds. You open up things you perhaps never wanted anybody to see. And you put it down on paper and you look at it. And when you get it into such a state that you can go no further, then you know that you're going to have to be humble enough to go to someone and sit down and tell them what you have written. Read it to them. Sometimes you ask for somebody to make comments on it, many times not at all. Just listen to me. That's the biggest thing that most alcoholics have to do, because we don't want other people to think badly of us. And if you made a real honest four-step inventory, there are things in there that you would rather nobody knew about. But it's an amazing thing. You can say these things, and pretty soon the people that you have sent it to can't remember what they read or what you said. And your life goes on. And you take another fourth step, and you go back to the fifth step. Many people take the fifth step from the podium when they begin to talk. Many of them take it as they go around talking to other people. It's a matter that letting another human being hear what you are, that makes a good sense about this thing. And then you get into the steps 8 and 9. It's very easy on 8, because he gives the alcoholic all the leeway he or she needs. It says, became willing to make amends. God knows it. Alcoholics are the most willing people in the world. You ask them something and ask them if they're willing to do it. Oh, sure, I'm willing. Willing, but don't ask me to do it. Just I'm willing to do it if and when. And then you get into the 9th and it tells you got to do it. That becomes a problem then. And once again, it starts all over. And you go through the 10th step, which is a reaffirmation of the 4th step and the things that you've written down. And then comes the 11th step, prayer and meditation. And when I got there, there was just like a wall had sprung up all of a sudden. Prayer and meditation. meditation I don't understand today. I don't know how you do it. I've never had anybody tell me. How do you meditate? What do you do? Do you just go over to the corner and sit down, stare at the wall? Your mind races this way and that way. Things happen, and you just sit there. Is that meditation? I don't know. I don't know whether you have to have a mantra like TM teaches or what it is. But worse than that is prayer. Since I am not a prayer, since I'm not one who believes in dogmatic prayers, where do I go to? What happens to me with prayer and meditation? And I argued and fought a long time about that. Kept looking for proof that prayer works. And I could answer many questions. You'd say, well, if it wasn't for prayer, I wouldn't be in this situation of goodness. And I'd say, oh, what do you know? That could happen anytime. It's just a happenstance. But then I heard a story. Most of you heard my story, but it's the one that I always refer to because it shows a period of time that if you're just patient, that your prayers will be answered. Incidentally, I now have and have had for several years now a spiritual advisor. She is not a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Her father is, but she isn't. She's 11 years old. She came out one day and we were standing there talking. Her dad had asked her and she came out of the temple. He said, did you pray today? And Heather said, yes, I did. And the father said, why did you pray? She said, because it makes me feel so good. And I heard her say that. And I went over to her and I said, Heather, you said it makes you feel so good. She said, yes. And I said, how? She said, just inside of me, I feel so good. That was the first time that I have ever found anything that affected me in a spiritual basis. Then came this story that was to prove that it doesn't make a difference how long you're around. If you're just patient, something will happen. It was about the priest who got out of his seminary and he was sent to a church in the Midwest. The church was filled with elderly people, no young ones at all. He did a great job as a priest in the church. But he became very lonely, and he didn't know what to do. And he went downtown to the local pet shop and asked if I had a pet there. He said, any kind of a pet. I don't care. He said, it would be nice if I could get a pet that I could train to do something, like a dog to jump or bark or not bark or whatever, but just something to take up my lonely time after my duties at the church are over. And the pet owner started to laugh, and the priest said, it isn't funny. He said, I know it isn't funny. But he said, it's an occasion that happened a year ago. He said, you have an elderly lady in your church. He said, she was living in the house that she was born in. She's never had a date in her entire life. She's never been out of the city, into the city. She's never been out of the county. Her entire life is around the church. And she came in a year ago, and she was very lonely. And she asked for something, and he said, like now, I just had one pet that she could have. And he said, it was a little parrot. And she said to me, does it talk? And he said, I told her, sure, it talks. And she said, well, if you're sure it talks, I'll take the parrot. And he said, so I told her, you take this parrot, it's all right, you take him home, and don't open up the cage or take the hood off until you get her home. Set her on your dining room table, and then you can take the hood off. And he said, I guarantee you, she'll talk. And so he said, she took her home. He said, today's the same thing. What I have here are two male parrots, little parrots, born together, raised together, can't separate them, because if I do, they'll both die. But he said, you can have them, you can train them. And the priest said, oh, that's great, I'll take them. And he took them home. And he started to teach one to say the Lord's Prayer and one to say the rosary, the beads for the church. And they became very proficient. And people came up from all over to hear these two birds recite the Lord's Prayer and the beads, the rosary. In the meantime, the little old lady had taken her bird home, set it up on a table, took off the hood, and this little parrot looked right out at her and said, my name is Minnie, and I'm a swinging whore. And this old lady had never heard that language, had no idea what was going on. She was absolutely terrified about it, and she went for a whole year putting up with this. She didn't want to get rid of the parrot, yet she could no longer stand the language. And so she came into the priest And she told a story about it. This terrible, this language. I don't understand it. I can't stand it any longer, whatever it is. And I have an idea. Do you think if we put my parrot in your cage with your birds, what they're the way they do it, that something might rub off on her and change her language? And he said, I don't know, but we can try. She brought her parrot in and put it in the bottom of his cage. His two birds were up on the rod, halfway up, looking down at this little newcomer. Her parrot looked up at these two, and she said, my name is Minnie, and I'm a swinging whore. And one of his parrots looked at the other and said, lay down to me, Charlie. Our prayers have been answered. So you see, if you just wait, if you do the footwork, if you believe that the power will in its time do for you what we couldn't do for yourself, you'll find that this program is very, very interesting, very filled with lots of things you never thought would occur. Absolutely fantastic. That's it, Harvey. Not like you, but not bad. Bye-bye.